This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Verse 24, Vayehi Kim Shalosh Chodoshim, it was approximately 3 months later that Yehuda is sitting in the Beis Din. Vayugad li Yehuda leimor, and in come some people with Tama. And Vayugad li Yehuda leimor, they say to Yehuda, the Yehuda is told, saying, Zonso Tomo Chalusecho, that your daughter-in-law Tamar has been mezana. She's had a cheap relationship. She's, and it's interesting because it's not adultery. She's not married. So what is the issue? Vayeshev chapter 38 verse 24. Sorry. Got it. And the word that's used is zonso. She's been cheap, she's been a prostitute. How else would a girl of this caliber land up being pregnant? What has been going on? The gamhein ahara luznunim, she's in fact pregnant with this illegitimate, not a mamzer. There's not a question of mamzer. Mamzer is only if she would be married or if the relationship would have been incestuous. But still, she's pregnant with this baby. What should the din be? What should we do with her? The problems are twofold. Number one, she's the daughter of Shem. And Shem had the law of a Kohen. We didn't have Kohenim yet at that time. The concept of a Kohen was not only introduced with the Jewish people. There was already a concept of Kohuno very, very early on, probably going back to Adam. And the Kohen was somebody who had dedicated himself 100% to the service of God, whether it was the firstborn or whether it was just Shem and his the people that he trained up. But in every generation there seems to have been a Kohen, and the daughter of a Kohen, there is a capital punishment for a daughter of a Kohen who has a prostitutional relationship. Now, what exactly that constitutes is quite complex. At what point it is? If the daughter of a Kohen, different views. Does it mean that she's living with somebody that she couldn't be married to, or she's living with somebody that she could be married to but isn't married to? Be that as it may, that's much more serious than anybody who's not a daughter of a Kohen, because that impacts on her father's status and dignity as a Kohen. And in those Noahide laws, the stature of the Kohen, of the priest, was enormously high. And they legislated in their laws, in their Noahide laws, that the daughter of a Kohen has to remain a virgin until she gets married, and if she doesn't, there's a death sentence. Additionally, it appears that after the flood, they legislated some very tough laws about sexual morality, because they realized that was one of the reasons for the flood. The things have become completely chaotic, and they legislated some very tough laws which don't apply today but did apply then. I'll try and find some reference to those laws for you. And the Radak says the reason is that since she had not yet had Yibum, it was as if she was married. She had not had Chalitza, she had not been released by Yehuda and his family, nor had she been married into them, so it was as if she's kind of betrothed and not married. So that's how they treated it at that time. There are a number of different views as to why this was such a serious problem. Rashi says that Bito Shel Shem Hoiso, she was the daughter of Shem, and that's why. This was something serious, because he was a Kohen, and therefore that was the law that applied. Then there's no death sentence for that at all.
But
a man and a woman who are not married have relations with one another, there's no big deal.
What happens if she's pregnant? What
would
that baby?
She's the mother and he's the father, and he and she were a little naughty. Those aren't the problems are where she's married. The problems are where it's incestuous. That doesn't mean that that's encouraged. And the Torah uses a very derogatory kind of word for it. The Torah doesn't like that at all. And the Rambam talks about the fact that in times until the Torah was given, a man would see a woman he liked and take her home. But the Rambam didn't know that in the 1990s we would be doing that again, that we've gone back to the way it was in pre-Torah times. You met a girl at a bar and you took her home, and the Rambam says, this was horrific. And therefore engagement was introduced, and then marriage. And the purpose of engagement, which we now do, because our engagements aren't engagements at all, and they're really nothing, but there is a halakhic place for an engagement, and the thing being is a kind of a preparation. So if you say that an engagement is nothing, because what is it really? It's just two people saying that they're going to get married, which they might or might not do. Then the marriage is like, from a halakhic point of view, nothing has preceded it. So it's like old times, like the Rambam says. You met somebody and you took them to the chuppah and married them. And therefore what we often do today, so the Hasidim certainly do it sometimes, we do it as well, is we do tanoim at the wedding, before the wedding. Tanoim is an undertaking by both parties to get married, which should precede the marriage. And the Rambam puts that in as an evolution in civilization, that people didn't just see a pretty girl and take her home, but they sat and talked about it. She's a woman in her own right. She's entitled to negotiate, to discuss it. And the tanoim are two parties and their families coming to an agreement that this is something that they want to do and plan to do in such and such a time period. The Rambam brings that as a major step forward in civilization. So the first thing was, there wasn't even a wedding. People, a man saw a nice girl, took her home and kept her as long as he wanted to, and dumped her when he wanted to, and that was the end of it. Then there was marriage, and the idea of tanoim, of there being something, a precursor even to marriage, was even a further evolution in civilization, according to the Rambam. So in no way does the Torah like it or suggest it at all. And there are other problems and complications, questions of nidah and questions of mikvah, and there are all sorts of things around and around. But the problem here was not that there's certainly no death sentence or no based in punishment. There's nothing criminal about that at all. That's the question of the standards of the families. But in her case, there seems to be something criminal, because she's brought before Yehuda for judgment. And it's either the question that she was the daughter of Shane, or the Chizkuni said. Also, Geder Ba'aros, they made some very strict laws after the flood, made some very strict laws that there should only be marriage, and without marriage it shouldn't be. And there's a death penalty if they instituted at that time. So now he finds her in front of him. He has no idea whatever that this is the same girl that he met. Nothing at all. Bayomer Yehuda, so his first major challenge is his own daughter-in-law, who he obviously thinks very highly of, is brought before him to be judged on a capital offense. What does he do? And immediately Yehuda's response is, Otsi'uha v'tisoreh, death sentence. That's the law. That's what has to be. She has to be taken to be killed by burning, which was the punishment that they had at that time. That the Ibn Noach had.
But if it's his own daughter-in-law, wouldn't he say, I can't judge this?
No. At that time, again, as well, after the laws of the Torah were given, at that time, the same as the brothers judged Yosef. And at that time, there weren't that many people. There was nobody more qualified. And he did judge it. So that's as tough and as harsh and almost as cruel as that is, shows in Yehuda the one side of him of being absolutely straight down the line and unaffected by personal relationships. Now let's look at her. He would say, so she is now brought. She's given the death sentence. Just picture the scene. There's Tamar. She knows exactly what's happened. There's her father-in-law who happens to be the judge. Case is brought. Father-in-law listens. This is a death sentence according to the laws of this land. This is a capital offense. Nothing we can do about this. It's rightful. What does she do? Kimutseis. she's taken away. She arrest her, they take her away. And they didn't waste much time in those days. If the decision was it was a death sentence, it was usually implemented the same day. It's not like here that they sit on death row for 20 years. That was it, and it was quick work. V'hi sholcho el chami olemur. She puts a little package together, and she asks for her last wish is that this package should be delivered to her father-in-law. And inside is a note. V'isha sher eile lo anachi horo. I'm pregnant to the man who owns these things. Remember what she took from him? The ring and his stick and all those things. Packages that, and she sends it quietly to him, not publicly. Nobody else knows what's in the package. But Tomer, and she said, Hakerno, identify the miach hasemes v'apasilim v'amate ho'ele. To who owns this ring, these seals, and this stick? She takes an enormous chance, because what would have to happen now, Yehuda would have to say, hold the death sentence, I'm responsible, I need the death sentence too, or whatever the implication of that would be, or he would have to just keep quiet, just say nothing. It's his child, true, but nobody would ever find out. Why did she do it ahead of time?
Why didn't she do it ahead of time? She's brought to the court. Why didn't she do this? I mean, she's not doing this publicly now. So
avoid the whole thing.
Waiting to have this
It was 3 months that this happened, so she was probably just recognized as being pregnant. And I don't know whether she would have done it when she was about to do it, or she wasn't going to do anything. We don't know what her intention was there. And here we see once again the greatness of Yehuda. Vayakir Yehuda, Yehuda immediately identifies Vayomer, and he now makes a public statement in the third person, so he's not talking to her, he's talking to the public. Tzodko mimeni, she is far more righteous than I. Ki alken lo nesatir l'shelo v'ni. The reason that she did this is because I did not give her to Shelo, my son. V'lo yosaf oid l'dato, and he had no further relations with her, is the simple translation of that. But if you look at the Rashi, the Lo Yosaf Od, the last Rashi on 26 on Kafaz, Yesh Omrim Lo Hosif. There are some who say, that's the Sifri, that it means he had no further relations with her. He took care of her and took care of the child, but he didn't marry her. The Yesh Omrim Lo Posak, but the Gemara says that what this means and proves it from the usage of the words, that he never left her, that he married her, he loved her, and she became his beloved wife.
Well, I don't understand. If it says he was not intimate with her anymore,
that's what it says in English.
Right.
In the Hebrew, it says the lo yosaf, and the lo yosaf could mean two things.
Uh-huh.
That means that he did not again withdraw from her, or he did not again have relations with her.
Uh-huh.
Difference between the Gemara and the Sifri, and Rashi goes on to prove from an Unklus translation in Bamidbar that the Lo Yosaf means, and he did not leave her, he did not desist from her. Going through the process, she, an important Rashi, a few important Rashis, let's learn them. In Chafhei 25, she sent this package to her father-in-law. Says Rashi, she did not want to confront him, and maybe this answers your point. Lori, at no point did she want to confront him and say, I am pregnant from you, because that would have caused him embarrassment. And interestingly, the embarrassment is not necessarily only in public. Anything that would have put him in a situation that would have caused him lahal bin poro means to go pale. So we're not just talking about a mild embarrassment, we're talking about a severe embarrassment. Instead, she says, Le'isha asher eilolo, expands Rashi, Omro, she said, Im yodeh me'atzmo. If he's going to admit it, let him do that of his own will. Ve'im lav yisrafuni. And if not, let them burn me. the al bin ponov, but at least I will not have been guilty of causing him embarrassment. It's more than embarrassment, it's shame. Mikan omru, and from here we learn, noach lo la'odom shiyapilu lekivshon ha'esh. She's not criticized for this, she's lauded for this. And we in fact learn a principle from this, which is a principle in Jewish law, that it is better to die, to throw yourself into a fiery furnace, v'al yalbin p'nei chaveru v'ravin, but do not cause severe embarrassment to your friend in public. And she innovated that law that damaging somebody's dignity is murder. You're killing something in the person, and we're not allowed to kill to save our own lives. If the only way you can save your own life is by killing somebody else, you're not allowed to save your life that way. And her innovation was that killing a part of somebody is like killing all of somebody. If you're not allowed to kill a person in total, nor are you allowed to kill a part of them to save your own dignity or to save your own life even. And that she would rather have her life taken from her and never be responsible for having caused him that. There are times when people cause their own embarrassment, and that's a different thing, but in this case that isn't so, because he didn't know who she was, she seduced him, she felt responsible for it, and she wasn't going to embarrass him. But what she does say to him is she's quite forceful in the note that she sends him, and saying hakerno, en no, says Rashi, era loshon bakashal. Hakerno means please, I beg of you, identify. She wasn't saying identify if you please, here it is, you know, it's up to you. She was saying, I beg of you, I implore you, identify and admit. Hakerno b'rocha, recognize your creator. V'alta abed sholosh nefoshes, and don't kill three people. Because if you don't, you'll be killing me and the baby, and you'll be killing yourself as well. And that's implied in her statement. She's saying, I'm leaving it to you, but I'm imploring you not to let this go, but to recognize this and to come forward.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If she was so concerned about embarrassing him, then why did she seduce him and set him up for that?
Because she knew that was the only way to the Mashiach. She had tried everything else, she had waited, he wasn't doing anything. And back to our discussions of the need to incorporate that, and we'll see what happens in the next sentence as well. But she knew that there was no alternative. It needed to be done, and it was incredibly high risk. And the amazing thing, you look all the way through, incredibly high risk. When the first risk we discussed was, who said he would fall for her? Mm. That was just even trying it was the risk of rejection, the risk of failure.
It's often very public. It's not a private way of going about doing it.
What should you mean? The way that, yeah, absolutely, and that we discussed, bringing in that whole in order to bring in the
pregnant private,
the passion.
I mean, you get pregnant private, you can't stay pregnant privately.
It's going to come out sooner or later. Yes, but it wouldn't. But she was willing to take the risk that she would be seen as a harlot and burnt, even though there was a small chance. Either she knew Yehuda well enough to know it wasn't such a small chance that that's the way he would operate, or as we learned a week or two ago, that the great opportunity you will sometimes risk a lot for, even when the small upside, even when the chance is small, if the upside is infinite. One of the things she teaches is you risk. When the upside is infinite, you risk. And she does, and she takes enormous risks, and here too, without pushing it any further. He shapes up and says, Tzod Komimeni, not only does he admit to it, but he elevates her and says, she's right, she's a righteous woman, much more so than I. And Rashi learns, and the Gemara learns, the phrasing of the sentence a little bit differently, this 26. Vayakir Yehuda, and Yehuda recognized, Vayomer, and he said, now this simple way of translating it is the way I did, which is Tzod Kol Mimeni, she has been more righteous than I. The way the Gemara translated additionally is Tzod Kol, she is right, she is righteous. Mimeni, the baby is from me. I am the father.
Even though it's one word?
No, it's not one word, it's two words. Tzod Kol Mimeni, she is right. Mimeni, it is from me. But Rashi explains further, there is still a third level of meaning which the Gemara puts to it, and that is Shiyotso Baskov Omer, that at that time, the moment Yehuda said Tzodko, she is right, Mimeni wasn't said by him. Mimeni was a heavenly voice. God came and said, Mimeni, this is all from me. I made all this happen. What does that mean? Explains Rashi. Mimeni umi iti yotzu advarim, this was decreed by me a long time ago. because of the way she conducted herself with tznius in her father-in-law's house. I decreed that the kings would come from her. And I decreed that the kings would come from the shevet, from the house of Yehuda. So my two decrees made this inevitable. I said Tamar would be a mother of kings, and I said Yehuda would be a father of kings. And yes, Yehuda did have the opportunity to do Yibam the normal way, but she saw that wasn't happening. And I wanted, if we now go back to the Al-Shikhs' garden, I want in this royal household there to be all this passion. There was no other way it could be. God is almost giving it his retrospective stamp of approval and saying, I didn't tell anybody to do it, but now that it's done, I'd better tell you it had to be. There was no other way. It couldn't be done any other way. Mimeni, this is from me. And he then marries her and stays with her. They have twins. The one is Peretz and the other one is Zerach, and that's the beginning of the household of Yehuda, from which the house of King David eventually develops.
Why was Yehuda not willing to do Yibam and marry her?
We don't know.
He lost two sons to her.
He might have been worried about the risk. He might have, the question is why he didn't give her to Shelah. To Shelah he didn't give her because he was afraid of losing another son. There's a law that if a woman gets married once and a man dies young and she marries another man and he dies young, there's a dispute as to whether you try a third time or that's it. But there's a point at which the principle of Chazaka, you say there's something about this relationship that is man-killing. And Yehuda was concerned about the risk for Shelah, and why he didn't give to Shelah. And as for himself, he probably never even thought of it as a possibility. This was his daughter-in-law. He probably never even thought of it as a possibility for himself. And only through this whole intrigue did he realize this was an amazing woman and a very attractive woman and somebody you could have this kind of a relationship with and married her.
She was a widower at the time.
Yes. Now, immediately afterwards, we run into the next story, which as I introduced to you last week, is so important in its contrast with this, is the Yosef Hurad Mitzrayim. Now, what about Yosef? Why should we be moving from Yehuda to Yosef? And I told you that there are going to be two Mashiach powers, two Mashiach forces in the world. The Mashiach that will be descended from Yehuda and the Mashiach that will be descended from Yosef. One coming from Rachel and one coming from Leah. We'll study the Mashiach ben Yosef in a little bit more detail next week, but what's essential to Mashiach ben Yosef is that in the Kabbalistic writings it appears what's going to happen, and it doesn't seem it's happened yet, it appears that it's going to be happened, is the Jews will have a Mashiach. He will be a warrior. He will conquer nations. He will conquer Eretz Israel. He will establish Jerusalem, and there will then be a war. The nations of the world won't accept this, and they will attack, and he will be killed in war. And only afterwards a Mashiach ben Yehuda will arise, who does not live in Israel, who lives outside of Israel, and is familiar with non-Jewish authorities and with the way of the world and with the governments of the world. And he will negotiate an agreement. He will come with the backing of the nations of the world. So the battles are going to take place with Mashiach ben Yosef, and he dies in battles. It's a very interesting. There's this purity, and he's going to fight a religious war, and he's going to be killed. And then the diplomat, the man who comes in, will be from the descendant of the house of David. He's going to be a much more balanced man who brings with him the power of the world's nations, the world's authorities, and will reestablish the Jews. But there will be a very painful time in between where we will lose Israel, and that's one of the reasons that the religious Jews are reluctant to talk about Israel at the moment as the beginning of the redemption and all of that kind of thing, because there's still probably a phase. Now, you might claim that we've been through that phase already, that somehow we've had this Mashiach ben Yosef, but it doesn't look like it. It looks like we're still going to get it. And when you see the tendency in the world to move to such religious polarization, and you get the fundamentalism coming in both in our religion and in others, one almost sees this coming out, and we're going to elect a really very probably a real fundamentalist leader of the Jewish people who's going to wage wars and fight and think he can conquer America and anybody else who opposes what he's doing, And Israel will go through a very tough time. It might be a very short time, but a very difficult time, until the Mashiach ben Yehuda, who comes from outside of Eretz Israel, will bring the nations of the world with the Mashiach era. And that's why here we're dealing with these two powers and where they come from. So Yehuda, we've got some kind of a sense, both from our study of Yehuda here and from our study of David in Shmuel, some kind of a sense of who they are and where they come from. Yosef's a different kind of a man, but also the Yosef who rad Mitzrayim, we're told. Yosef went to Egypt, he was taken down to Egypt, he was bought by Potiphar, who was the minister of catering for Paro. He was extremely successful. He began to manage and to run his master's empire. He was the chief executive of Potiphar's entire estate. Potiphar loved him, admired him, respected him, trusted him. And the more he entrusted Yosef with, the more God blessed the house of the Egyptian, the Torah tells us. So Potiphar's wealth just magnified, and he realized that Yosef had something to do with that. Vayehi birkat Hashem b'chol asher yesh lo b'bayis u'asodeh, and the blessing of Hashem fell on everything that Potiphar had, whether at home or out in the field. He left everything to Yosef. He didn't know what was going on in his home, except that which he ate. And then the Torah says, Vayehi Yosef yefei sar v'yefei mareh, and Yosef was extremely handsome. So here we have this charismatic, beautiful looking man, the only Jew in Egypt, away from his home and family, incredibly successful and gaining power all the time.
They didn't know he was a Jew though, right?
No, it would appear not. Now this statement that Yosef was so beautiful is taken two ways. The one is as a compliment, that God, the Torah is telling us that he had this charisma and this beauty and he was so attractive, and it prepares us for the next part of the story. But Rashi also says in verse 6 of chapter 39, Vayehi Yosef yefei toar, kivan shero'o atzmo moshel, when he saw himself now a ruler and a manager and mixing in high society, Hitchil Ochel v'shoyse, he used to banquet, he used to party, he became a socialite. U'mesalto b'saru, and he would go to the hairdresser very frequently. Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God said, Avicho misabel v'ato mesalto b'sarecha. Your father's mourning for your loss, and you're sitting in hairdressers making yourself beautiful and partying. Is there no linkage? Are you not linking into it all? What's going on in the wider picture? Are you completely taken up with your own success? Ani Megareb Bechoros Adroev. I'll show you where all this leads, says God, and so the story starts unfolding. It was after these things, Vatiso Eshes Adonav Esenel Yosef. All of a sudden, the wife of Potiphar starts noticing that Yosef is a very attractive man. Vatomer, and she said, very, very blatantly, Shichorim, you lie with me. I want to sleep with you. Vayemoen. Do you notice the trop on the word Vayemoen? Vayemoen means and he refused. Mm-hmm. The trop is a shalshelet, which is used only a few times in the Torah, and if you know how it is sung, then you'll know what it means. It's the way it is sung is Vayemoen. What does that mean?
Can't make that decision.
Yeah, he refused. But it wasn't a clear-cut, easy refusal, because she was a very attractive woman too. Vayomer Eleshes Adonav, so he reasons with her and he says, Hein Adoni lo yodaiti ma advice. After all, my master doesn't even know what goes on in the house. V'chol asher lo nasan biyodi, he's given everything that he owns into my hand. And in a gadol b'bayis hazeh mimeni, there's nobody senior to me in this house. V'lo chosach mimeni me'umo, he keeps nothing away from me. Ki imo yisoch, the only thing he keeps away from me is you. Basher atishto, because you're his wife. So it wouldn't be right. It would be completely against the relationship I have with my employer. It wouldn't be right at all. It would be immoral. How could I do something so evil? So number one, it wouldn't be expedient. I've got a job here, and he made it very clear to me, everything's yours, you can do what you want, this is the one area you can't touch. For me to do that would be it would blow my career. Second, it's evil. Leaving aside the fact that it's not expedient, It's evil. Now, why did he go onto the second argument?
He needs the backup.
Yeah, he's obviously, the first argument he's already found a way around. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not expedient, but who would know? And if she's on his side, that could be even more expedient. He's probably worked out that the expediency could deal with. So then he says to himself and to her, but it's immoral. It's just wrong. I can't do it. He comes to a third one. And he says, V'chatosi l'Hashem. V'chatosi l'Elokim. I will sin to God. Why does he need the third one? He's figured out the immorality one. And in Egypt, it's not so immoral. Let them do as the Romans do. In my civilization, it's immoral. But not in theirs. So what's the big deal? So the expedience I'll find a way around, the immorality I'll find a way around. So what's the big deal? What's left? He says, V'chatosi l'Hashem. At the end of the day, I know Hashem wouldn't approve of it, and therefore, I can't do it.
Rabbi, you said that the trope indicated that he was vacillating. But,
right.
Unless this English is really wrong, which maybe it is, it says he adamantly refused. So if there's any truth to that, then there's a conflict.
That adamantly, I don't know where they get that on. But your main is he refused.
Okay.
That's it. Maybe
they're trying to cover up.
Maybe. And it's clear that it was a process of refusal. It wasn't. By Yehi Kedabra Yosef Yomya. And it was as she spoke to Yosef day after day. She didn't give in. So she detected there was still a possibility. And she worked on him and kept him. The way Shomai Leo, he did not listen to her. Lishka Vetzla Lihi Yosimo. To lie with her, listen to this phrase. It's so, so interesting. He did not agree, did not listen to her. Lishka Vetzla, she started saying, what does Rashi say on Lishka Vetzla? Afilu Beloi Tashmish, even without sexual relations. So she started saying, just come lie down on the bed. You don't have to do anything wrong with that. Just come lie, let's talk a little bit. He wouldn't. Why? And that Liya Yus Imo, to be with her, says Rashi, Lo'ilam Habo, because he realized that relationship, establishing a sexual relationship, it establishes a soul relationship, and that is a linkage even to the world to come. And that was something he was not interested in. So with all the physical attraction at the end, what he's saying is when she says, Lishka, so such a liar, what kept him away was the thought of an Olam Haba with this woman that I don't need. This world, perhaps to have a pleasant few hours with her is fine, but that will mean a connection that you don't break. There's something that remains attached even to Olam Haba for the world to come, and that he didn't want. However, Vayihika Ayom Azeh, it was on a certain day, so he came to the house to do his work. Translated accurately, and there was no man from the men of the house there in the house. Very clumsy phrasing. Have a look at Rashi. It was on this particular day. That means, what was this day? When a special day came, Yom Tzchok, it was a day of laughter, it was a celebration day. Yom Eid Shalohem, it was a Yom Tzif, one of the festivals. Shalchu Kulam Leves Avedo Zorah, everybody went to the temple. Omro, she said, Ein Li Yom Hagun Li Zakek Li Yosef Ka Yom Hazeh, there's no better day than today. It's a celebration day, it's a reason to have some drinks. Everybody's gone to the temple, the house is empty, this is perfect. Omro Lohim, she said to them, Cholam Yibeni Yechol Alech, I'm not feeling well, I'm not going to the temple. So now he comes to the house and there's nobody in the house except her. What should he do?
Leave.
Yeah, he should work on his computer at home that day. And he should then explain to his master, it wouldn't have been proper for me to be in the house, your wife was there alone, it wouldn't have been right. That's what he should have done, such a tzaddik, that's what he should have done. Says he went there to do his work. Look in Rashi again, Rabu Shmuel, two views. Had Omar, one said, Malachta Mamish, it's true, he went to do his work. Shouldn't have, but he did. Had all my life for tzorch of imo, and others said no. He went to do what he decided he would do this day too, because there's no other reason he should be going, and therefore he had succumbed. So now the fact is everybody was away. She's alone in the house. It's a day of celebration, and he decides he's going in. So she's decided. He's decided. He goes in. Batis pesehu bevigdo lemor, and she grabbed him by the clothes, saying, Shichvo imi, now sleep with me, now lie with me. And something happens. Vayazoiv bigdoi biyodo, he takes off his coat and leaves it in her hand. She's grabbed his coat, he gets out of his coat, leaves her holding it, Vayonath, and he runs, Vayetze achutza, he runs outside into the street. what happened if we go further in the Rashi? His reason that it's not inexpedient, his reason that it's not immoral, and he must now have reason that it's not a sin. Because he's been through all that before. He said, up until now, the reason he didn't succumb to it is because he said it was a sin. If he's now decided to go back into the house for some reason, he's figured out that it's not a sin again by Nevuah, he knows that it's a relationship that's meant to happen because he lands up marrying their daughter. So he also knows that Mashiach ben Yosef is going to come from this relationship. So there's a major force of attraction other than just the physical attraction. He knows there's something going on here. And he's probably worked out, however, the same as Yehuda and David and all of them, but technically, so here we have a very parallel situation. Technically, he's worked out it's not inexpedient, it's not immoral, it's not a sin. And therefore, I'm going to do it. The same as Yehuda, the same as David, the same as all these cases. But he doesn't do it. That's the difference. When it comes to it, he leaves his jacket in her hand and he runs out. Why, says Rashi? Eloshiniris lo demus yuknoi shel aviv. He saw his father there. So when it says there was no man from the men of the house there in the house, the Chazal learned that there was another man there in the house. And that was this image of his father. And the image of the father is really important, because the image of the father is opposed to the image of a teacher. The image of a teacher is the person who teaches you what the Torah says, what you can do, what you can't do. But a parent does something else. And I think I touched on it on Monday night. What a parent does is teaches a child what we don't do, even if it doesn't say so anywhere. There's just certain ways of behavior, certain ways to behave and not to behave that a parent ought to teach a child. Nobody else is going to teach a child. And the seeing of his father's image was his father's just saying, you know, you've worked it all out. It's not expedient, it's not inexpedient, and it's not immoral, and it's not a sin, but it's not right. It's just not right. And without going through, in other words, having technically satisfied himself, he looks at the spirit of the thing and says, that is wrong, and he leaves it. And here we have the contrast between these people, Yosef on the one hand, Yehuda on the other hand. In Yehuda's cases, not just his own, but all the way through that family, we have these amazingly passionate relationships being constructed with technique sailing close to the wind technically. Here we have the same passion and the same technical balancing act, but the denial of it. And that's the Mashiach ben Yosef force, and that's the force of uncompromising purity, of no passion, or passion not being allowed to dominate, of mastering passion and all of that kind of thing. And it's interesting, that is the force that will be used to fight evil, but that is not the force that will be used to sustain the post-messianic age. So there's a role almost, and I'm seeing it play out today so interestingly, there's a role in uncompromising right as a contrast to completely degenerate wrong. When wrong has no bounds, right has to be laser beam shot. But when that battle has taken place, you need something far more flexible and far more passionate and far more human than the Mashiach ben Yosef kind of influence. And as I said, next week we'll have a few texts as to what this Mashiach ben Yosef is and what this Mashiach ben Yehuda is, and try and understand how they interact in light of the story of Yosef, because of Yosef's righteousness. They're both righteous, Yehuda and Yosef, both righteous, but a completely different type of righteousness, a completely different color, a completely different texture of righteousness. Both have a role. Mashiach ben Yosef, very sharp, very critical, very short. The role of Yehuda, much more complex and much more eternal.
Right. You know, Stucky, when you were talking about it, about how, again, it was his coat and his father, like it was not the coat, the original coat of his father, you know, here's God's father's face, and then left his coat, so we had that coat imagery again.
Interesting.
And then it also struck me, too, that it's almost like externally he was ready to succumb to the physical pleasure, but then, like, his pure soul was able to run free from it, you know, and release it.
I think that's beautiful. I think that's right. But he's, I'd like to think a little bit more about the linkage between the coats, because this is the only case where the coat is so emphasized.
Yeah,
and that there is an externalism in Yosef.
Yeah.
You see it in his physical beauty. You see it in sitting at the hairdresser. You see it in the coat of many colors. You see it in the coat here. You see it in the image of his father dominating. These are all external forces. Yehuda operates so much from inside himself. And in his whole tradition, the mistakes he makes and the victories he has, it's all from inside himself. With Yosef, it's all an external force. The father, it's God, it's the coat, it's that. I think there is a lot in that image. But there is an externalism in Yosef that is pure and untouched. Because the internal subjective part of us is not pure. Yes, deep, deep down there's a soul that is untouched. But if you take the totality of the human personality, it's not pure. It's affected both positively and negatively by its history, by everything that it's been doing. The object of things remain pure. The things that just get handed down in writing and haven't changed one little bit generation from generation, that's the purity. And it seems to be in the Mashiach ben Yosef that sense of a commitment to those formulas of truth, those unchanged formulas of truth, whereas in Yehuda there was more of an evolution of being. And this conflict, these are two very different types of operating in different types of righteousness, each with their own place.
Yeah. Where does one get that inner strength or whatever it is to know that she's not deserving of the death penalty, but to keep it quiet and just perhaps not know if she's going to forfeit her life?
That comes from the same fortitude that one has giving one's life to save another human being. So all these acts of heroism that one hears about, not only in times of war, but even in ordinary times, people doing amazing things to save somebody else, risking their lives and sometimes losing their lives in the process, is the value of another person's life taken one step further. And once one has inculcated into oneself that the destruction of a part of another person is as serious as the destruction of the whole person, then it becomes easier to link into that heroic side of the human being. That causing somebody to diminishing somebody's self-esteem, certainly in the eyes of other people, is a loss of being for that person. And to realize that and understand that, it's something that is critical, and this is something in the work environment, it's something we face a lot in our work, where that's not recognized at all, where there's an abusiveness that is allowed to take place in a workplace that is murderous. You're actually killing people, you're killing parts of people, and you think because the person walks out physically intact from work that day that you haven't killed anything, and you have. You've murdered little bits of it. And Tamar was completely committed to that understanding that there's no such thing as, you don't ever murder a person completely. You murder his body, his soul's still intact. So what are you going to say? That's not murder. It's always partial. You can't destroy a person totally. So the whole principle of murder is destroying parts of people. And therefore the prohibition of murder is you're not permitted to destroy any part of the human being. Not just that you're not permitted to destroy a human being. And I think more than the fortitude within itself, it's the complete dominance of the understanding of the value of another human being. And the wrong in damaging them, or certainly destroying a part of that human being.
Well, then does that go on to mean that many of us may have intentionally or not intentionally murdered parts of people?
Yes.
And how do you repent for such a thing? We're all murderers, most of us, or I know I would be.
And that's why, if you look at some of the things we say in Yom Kippur, we say some pretty harsh things, and people say things like, yeah, but I've never murdered, I've never killed. But we do kill people and parts of people as we go through our lives, and the way to do it is to do the opposite. To try and repair where one can with people that one knows one is damaged, and just to try and rectify one's life, that one becomes increasingly sensitive to this. Not only does one not kill people, but one tries to uplift people. If killing a part of somebody is such a terrible sin that you must give your life for it, imagine what elevating somebody does, what giving life to somebody does. And just as a mother gives birth and gives life to somebody, someone can give life to partial life to somebody. Just give them more of a liveliness, more of an energy to somebody, because you've made them feel better about themselves, not in a flattering way, but in a genuine way. So one has to see the two sides of the coin. If it's so damaging to diminish a person, how great and wonderful and how much credit does God give us for elevating other human beings and making them feel valuable?
But if we have done that already, is there any way to rectify it?
With people we know, yes, just try to lift up their self-esteem again, apologize, say, I think I've done this to you. I think in my interactions with you, I've been damaging. It's not something I did intentionally, but this is... Sorry?
I thought murder was unforgivable.
No, but here it can be rectified. The one thing, the reason it's unforgivable is because once a person's real dead, there's nothing you can do about it. Here you can go back and you can, by a true apology, if you can really deal with a person and make him feel that you really feel it, and that you're sorry, you can more than recover the damage. You can actually elevate the person even greater. Remember, we once learned that a relationship after an apology is more intimate than it was before the sin, before the wrong. When somebody has wronged somebody, another person, and there's a genuine apology and reconstruction, that relationship is often better than one that never had.
This, when you're reprimanding children, which as mothers you're doing, I'm doing constantly, it's very hard to keep this in mind when you're having to repeat the same instructions and even, you know, tochacha all the time. So how do you reconcile that?
The way that you try to do that, there are times when you do have to embarrass somebody because they're just not learning and you need to cause pain for the growth. But one has to be sure that that's what one's doing and that's why one's doing it, and that growth that results from that. So as an educational tool, sometimes a parent and the teacher is allowed to use embarrassment limitedly and very, very carefully. If somebody, you know, if you're training somebody to think and they keep on asking stupid questions, there comes a time you're able to tell them they're asking stupid questions. And if they're embarrassed by that, that's part of the training. So the Mishnah says, Ein habayish and lomed, if you're going to be too sensitive in your learning activity, you won't learn. You've either got to open yourself to embarrassment, or you won't grow. So as an educator, there's a part of that that has to take into account, that one is almost giving permission to a parent or an educator to embarrass one if one needs it. Otherwise you're saying, look, I want you to educate me, but don't ever cause me pain. That's not going to happen. But the important thing is that in that process, number one, that with every pound of tofacha, there's a ton of praise. Not at the same time necessarily, but that should be the relationship. That the child never feels that you're out to get the child, that you don't like the child, that you don't value the child. And the praise has to be genuine. And you have to seek opportunities for praise. And the other is that the tofacha, the criticism, is directed at actions, not at the person,
right.
Whereas the praise is directed at the person. And that's sometimes something we don't often do. Usually we tell our kids they got good grades, they played a great game, they did something nice. But we very seldom tell the kids, you're a great kid.
Mm-hmm.
You're an exceptional person. What you did now shows that you're an exceptional person. And by doing that, that balances it. So you think I'm an exceptional person, and that's why you didn't like what I did in such and such a situation. So you criticize my action because you think I'm worthy. You think I'm valuable. That's how the tofacha has to come out. Not I think you're not valuable, I think you're useless. That's murder. But to say I think you're valuable and therefore I don't approve of that action, that's not murder, that's education.
Thank you.